"What happened," said Gaspode, "was that someone put a dragon in a box right up against the wall inside the courtyard, right? And then they went and hid behind one of the statues and pulled a string, and next minute, bang!"
"Bang?"
"That's right. Then our friend nips into the hole for a few seconds, right, comes out again, trots round the courtyard, and next minute there's assassins everywhere, and he's among them. What the hell? Another man in black no one notices, see?"
"You mean he's still in there?"
"How do I know? Hoods and cloaks, everyone in black."
"How come you were able to see all this?"
"Oh, I always nip into the Assassin's Guild on a Wednesday night, mixed grill night, see?"
Gaspode sighed at Angua's blank expression.
"The cook always does a mixed grill of a Wednesday night. No one ever eats the black pudding, so it's round the kitchen, see? Woof, woof, beg, beg. Who's a good boy, then? Look at the little bugger. He looks as though he understands every word I'm saying. Let's see what we've got here for a good doggy."
He looked embarrassed for a moment.
"Pride is all very well, but a sausage is a sausage," he said.
"Fireworks?" said Vimes. Dr. Cruces looked like a man grasping a floating log in a choppy sea.
"Yes, fireworks. Yes, for Founder's Day. Unfortunately, someone threw away a lighted match which ignited the box."
Dr. Cruces suddenly smiled.
"My dear Captain Vimes," he said, clapping his hands, "much as I appreciate your concern, I really..."
"They were stored in that room over there," said Vimes.
"Yes, but that's of no account."
Vimes crossed to the hole in the wall and peered inside. A couple of assassins glanced at Dr. Cruces and reached nonchalantly toward various areas of their clothing. He shook his head. His caution might have had something to do with the way Carrot put his hand on the hilt of his sword, but it could also have been because assassins did have a certain code, after all. It was dishonourable to kill someone if you weren't being paid.
"It seems to be some kind of museum," said Vimes. "Guild memorabilia, that sort of thing?"
"Yes, exactly. Odds and ends. You know how they mount up over the years?"
"Oh, well, that all seems in order," said Vimes. "Sorry to have troubled you, Doctor. I will be going. I hope I've not inconvenienced you in any way."
"Of course not. Glad to have been able to put your mind at rest."
They were ushered gently yet firmly towards the gateway.
"I should clean up this glass," said Captain Vimes, glancing at the debris again. "Someone could hurt themselves, all this glass lying around. Wouldn't like to see one of your people get hurt."
"We shall be doing it right this minute, Captain," said Dr. Cruces.
"Good, good. Thank you very much."
Captain Vimes paused at the doorway and then thumped the palm of his hand on his forehead.
"Oh, sorry, excuse me. Mind like a sieve these days. What was it you said was stolen?"
Not a muscle, not a sinew moved on Dr. Cruces' face.
"I didn't say anything was stolen, Captain Vimes."
Vimes gaped at him for a moment.
"Right, sorry, oh, of course you didn't. Apologies, were getting on top of me, I expect. I'll be going then."
The door slammed in his face.
"Right," said Vimes.
"Captain, why do..."
Carrot began. Vimes held up a hand. "That wraps it up, then," he said, slightly louder than necessary.
"Nothing to worry about. Let's get back to the yard. Where's Lance Constable? What's her name?"
"Here, Captain,"
said Angua, stepping out of the alley.
"Hiding, eh? And what's that?"
"Woof, woof, whine, whine, whine."
"It's a little dog, Captain."
"Good grief."
The clang of the big, corroded inhumation bell echoed through the Assassin's Guild. Black-clad figures came running from all directions, pushing and shoving in their haste to get to the courtyard. The Guild Council assembled hurriedly outside Dr. Cruce's office. His deputy, Mr. Downey, knocked tentatively on the door.
"Come."
The Council filed in. Cruce's office was the biggest room in the building. It always seemed wrong to visitors that the Assassin's Guild had such light, airy, well-designed premises, more like the premises of a gentleman's club than a building where death was plotted on a daily basis. Cheery, sporting prints lined the walls, although the quarry was not, when you looked closely, stags or foxes. There were also group etchings, and more recently, new-fangled iconographs of the guild, rows of smiling faces on black-clad bodies, and the youngest members sitting cross-legged in front, one of them making a face. There's always one. Down one side of the room was the big mahogany table where the elders of the guild sat in weekly session. The other side of the room held Cruce's private library and a small workbench. Above the bench was an apothecary cabinet, made up of hundreds of little drawers. The names on the drawer labels were in Assassin's Code, but visitors from outside the guild were generally sufficiently unnerved not to accept a drink. Four pillars of black granite held up the ceiling. They had been carved with the names of noted assassins from history. Cruces had his desk four square between them. He was standing behind it, his expression almost as wooden as the desk.
"I want a roll call," he snapped. "Has anyone left the guild?"
"No, sir."
"How can you be so sure?"
"The guards on the roof in Filigree Street say no one came in or went out, sir."
"And who's watching them?"
"They're watching one another, sir."
"Very well, listen carefully. I want the mess cleaned up. If anyone needs to go outside the building, I want everyone watched. And then the guild is going to be searched from top to bottom. Do you understand?"
"What for, Doctor?"
said a junior lecturer in poisons.
"For anything that is hidden. If you find anything and you don't know what it is, send for a council member immediately and don't touch it."
"But, Doctor, all sorts of things are hidden."
"This will be different. Do you understand?"
"No, sir."
"Good. And no one is to speak to the wretched watch about this. You, boy, bring me my hat."
Dr. Cruces sighed.
"I suppose I shall have to go and tell the patrician."
"Hard luck, sir."
The captain didn't say anything until they were crossing the brass bridge.
"Now then, Corporal Carrot," he said, "you know how I've always told you how observation is important."
"Yes, Captain, I've always paid careful attention to your remarks on the subject."
"So what did you observe?"
"Someone had smashed a mirror. Everyone knows assassins like mirrors. But if it was a museum, why was there a mirror in there?"
"Please, sir."
"Who said that?"
"Down here, sir. Lord Constable Cuddy."
"Oh, yes. Yes?"
"I know a bit about fireworks, sir. There's a smell you get after fireworks. Didn't smell it, sir. Smelled something else, sir."
"Well smelled, Cuddy.
And there were bits of burned rope and pulleys."
"I smelled dragon," said Vimes.
"Sure, Captain?"
"Trust me," Vimes grimaced. If you spent any time in Lady Ramkin's company, you soon found out what dragons smelled like. If something put its head in your lap while you were dining, you said nothing. You just kept passing it titbits and hoping like hell it didn't hiccup.
"There was a glass case in that room," he said. "It was smashed open. Something was stolen. There was a bit of card in the dust, but someone must have pinched it while old Cruces was talking to me. I'd give $100 to know what it said."
"Why, Captain?" said Corporal Carrot.
"Because that bastard Cruces doesn't want me to know."
"I know what could have blown the hole open," said Angua.
"What?"
"An exploding dragon."
They walked in stunned silence.
"That could do it, sir," said Carrot loyally. "The little devils go bang at the drop of a helmet."
"Dragon," muttered Vimes. "What makes you think it was a dragon, Lance Constable Angua?" Angua hesitated. "Because a dog told me" was not, she judged, a career-advancing thing to say at this point.
Women's intuition?" she suggested.
"I suppose," said Vimes, "you wouldn't hazard an intuitive guess as to what was stolen?" Angua shrugged. Carrot noticed how interestingly her chest moved.
"Something the assassins wanted to keep where they could look at it?" she said.
"Oh, yes," said Vimes. "I suppose next you'll tell me this dog saw it all." Woof!
Edward de Eth drew the curtains, bolted the door, and leaned on it.
It had been so easy.
He'd put the bundle on the table. It was thin and about 4 feet long. He unwrapped it carefully, and there it was. It looked pretty much like the drawing. Typical of the man, a whole page full of meticulous drawings of crossbows, and this in the margin, as though it hardly mattered. It was so simple. Why hide it away? Probably because people were afraid. People were always afraid of power. It made them nervous. Edward picked it up, cradled it for a while, and found that it seemed to fit his arm and shoulder very snugly.
"You're mine."
And that, more or less, was the end of Edward Death. Something continued for a while, but what it was and how it thought wasn't entirely human. It was nearly noon. Sergeant Colon had taken the new recruits down to the archery butts in Butt's Treat. Vimes went on patrol with Carrot. He felt something inside him bubbling over. Something was brushing the tips of his corroded but nevertheless still active instincts, trying to draw attention to itself. He had to be on the move. It was all that Carrot could do to keep up. There were trainee assassins in the streets around the guild, still sweeping up debris. "Assassins in daylight," snarled Vimes. "I'm amazed they don't turn to dust."
"That's vampires, sir," said Carrot.
"You're right. Assassins and licensed thieves and bloody vampires. You know, this was a great old city once, lad."
Unconsciously, they fell into step. Proceeding.
"When we had kings, sir."
"Kings? Kings? Hell no."
A couple of assassins looked around in surprise.
"I'll tell you," said Vimes. "A monarch's an absolute ruler, right? The head honcho."
"Unless he's a queen," said Carrot.
Vimes glared at him and then nodded.
"Okay, or the head honchet."
"No, that'd only apply if she was a young woman. Queens tend to be older. She'd have to be a honcherina? No, that'd be for very young princesses. No, a honchessa, I think."
Vimes paused. "There's something in the air in this city," he thought. "If the Creator had said, 'Let there be light,' in Ankh Morpork, he'd have got no further because of all the people saying, 'What colour?'"
"The Supreme Ruler, okay?" he said, starting to stroll forward again.
"Okay."
"But that's not right, see? One man with the power of life and death."
"But if he's a good man," Carrot began.
"What? What? Okay, okay, let's believe he's a good man. But his second in command, is he a good man too? You'd better hope so, because he's the Supreme Ruler too, in the name of the King. And the rest of the court, they've got to be good men. Because if just one of them's a bad man, the result is bribery and patronage."
"The patrician's a supreme ruler," Carrot pointed out.
He nodded at a passing troll. "Good day, Mr. Carbuncle."
"But he doesn't wear a crown or sit on a throne. And he doesn't tell you it's right that he should rule," said Vimes. "I hate the bastard, but he's honest. Honest like a corkscrew."
"Even so, a good man as king."
"Yes, and then what? Royalty pollutes people's minds, boy. Honest men start bowing and bobbing just because someone's granddad was a bigger murdering bastard than theirs was. Listen, we probably had good kings once, but kings breed other kings, and blood tells, and you end up with a bunch of arrogant, murdering bastards, chopping off queens' heads and fighting their cousins every 5 minutes. And we had centuries of that. And then one day a man said, 'No more kings.' And we rose up, and we fought the bloody nobles, and we dragged the king off his throne, and we dragged him into Sator Square, and we chopped his bloody head off. Job well done."
"Wow," said Carrot. "Who was he?"
"Who?"
"The man who said no more kings."
People were staring. Vimes's face went from the red of anger to the red of embarrassment. There was little difference in the shading, however.
"Oh, he was commander of the city guard in those days," he mumbled. "They called him Old Stoneface."
"Never heard of him," said Carrot.
"He, doesn't appear much in the history books," said Vimes. "Sometimes there has to be a civil war, and sometimes afterwards it's best to pretend something didn't happen. Sometimes people have to do a job, and then they have to be forgotten. He wielded the axe, you know. No one else would do it. It was a king's neck, after all. Kings are..." He spat the word, "special. Even after they'd seen the private rooms and cleaned up the bits, even then, no one had cleaned up the world. But he took the axe and cursed them all and did it."
"What king was it?" said Carrot.
"Lorenzo the Kind," said Vimes distantly.
"I've seen his picture in the Palace Museum," said Carrot. "A fat old man surrounded by lots of children."
"Oh, yes," said Vimes carefully. "He was very fond of children."
Carrot waved at a couple of dwarfs.
"I didn't know this," he said. "I thought there was just some wicked rebellion or something."
Vimes shrugged. "It's in the history books, if you know where to look."
"And that was the end of the kings of Ankh Morpork?"
"Oh, there was a surviving son, I think, and a few mad relatives. They were banished. That's supposed to be a terrible fate for royalty. I can't see it myself."
"I think I can. And you like the city, sir."
Well, yes. But if it was a choice between banishment and having me head chopped off, just help me down with a suitcase. Ah, we're well rid of kings. But I mean, the city used to work.
Still does, said Carrot. They passed the Assassin's Guild and drew level with the high, forbidding walls of the Fool's Guild, which occupied the other corner of the block.
Now it just keeps going. I mean, look up there.
Carrot obediently raised his gaze. There was a familiar building on the junction of Broadway and Alchemists. The facade was ornate, but covered in grime. Gargoyles had colonised it. The corroded motto over the portico said, "Neither rain nor snow nor glom of nit can stay these meffengers about their duty." And in more spacious days, that might have been the case, but recently someone had found it necessary to nail up an addendum which read, "Don't ask us about rocks, trolls with sticks, all sorts of dragons, Mrs. Cake, huge green things with teeth, any kinds of black dogs with orange eyebrows, reins of spaniels, fog, Mrs. Cake."
"Oh," he said, "the Royal Mail."
"The post office," corrected Vimes. "My granddad said that once you could post a letter there and it'd be delivered within a month without fail. You didn't have to give it to a passing dwarf and hope the little bugger wouldn't eat it before..."
His voice trailed off.
Sorry, no offence meant."
"None taken," said Carrot cheerfully.
"It's not that I've got anything against dwarfs. I've always said you'd have to look very hard before you'd find a better bunch of highly skilled, law-abiding, hard-working,
"Little buggers?"
"Yes. No."
They proceeded.
"That Mrs. Cake," said Carrot, "definitely a strong-minded woman, eh?"
"Too true," said Vimes.
Something crunched under Carrot's enormous sandal.
"More glass," he said. "It went a long way, didn't it?"
"Exploding dragons! What an imagination the girl has!"
"Woof, woof,"
said a voice behind them.
"That damned dog's been following us," said Vimes.
"It's barking at something on the wall," said Carrot.
Gaspode eyed them coldly.
"Woof, woof, bloody wine, wine," he said. "Are you bloody blind or what?"
It was true that normal people couldn't hear Gaspode speak because dogs don't speak. It's a well-known fact. It's well-known at the organic level, like a lot of other well-known facts which overrule the observations of the senses. This is because if people went around noticing everything that was going on all the time, no one would ever get anything done. This is another survival trait. Besides, almost all dogs don't talk. Ones that do are merely a statistical error and can therefore be ignored. However, Gaspode had found he did tend to get heard on a subconscious level. Only the previous day someone had absent-mindedly kicked him into the gutter and had gone a few steps before they suddenly thought, "I'm a bastard, what am I?"
"There is something up there," said Carrot. "Look, something blue hanging off that gargoyle."
"Woof, woof, woof, would you credit it?"
Vimes stood on Carrot's shoulders and walked his hand up the wall, but the little blue strip was still out of reach. The gargoyle rolled a stony eye towards him.
"Do you mind?" said Vimes. "It's hanging on your ear."
With a grinding of stone on stone, the gargoyle reached up a hand and unhooked the intrusive material. "Thank you."
"Ugh, enkung ick."
Vimes climbed down again.
"You like gargoyles, don't you, Captain?" said Carrot, as they strolled away.
"Yep, they may only be a kind of troll, but they keep themselves to themselves and seldom go below the first floor and don't commit crimes anyone ever finds out about. My type of people."
He unfolded the strip. It was a collar, or at least what remained of a collar. It was burnt at both ends. The word chubby was just readable through the soot.
"The devils," said Vimes. "They did blow up a dragon."
The most dangerous man in the world should be introduced. He has dissected a few, but only after they were dead, because he was an early form of free-thinking scientist and did not believe that human beings had been created by some sort of divine being. Dissecting people when they were still alive tended to be a priestly preoccupation. They thought mankind had been created by some sort of divine being and wanted to have a closer look at his handiwork. And had marvelled at how well they'd been put together, considering it had been done by unskilled labour. For several years, he hadn't moved outside a large, airy room, but this was okay, because he spent most of his time inside his own head in any case. There's a certain type of person it's very hard to imprison. He had, however, surmised that an hour's exercise every day was essential for a healthy appetite and proper bowel movements, and was currently sitting on a machine of his own invention. It consisted of a saddle above a pair of treadles which turned, by means of a chain, a large wooden wheel currently held off the ground on a metal stand. Another freewheeling wooden wheel was positioned in front of the saddle and could be turned by means of a tiller arrangement. He'd fitted the extra wheel and tiller so that he could wheel the entire thing over to the wall when he'd finished taking his exercise, and besides, it gave the whole thing a pleasing symmetry. He called it the Turning the Wheel with Pedals and Another Wheel machine. Lord Vetinari was also at work. Normally he was in the oblong office or seated in his plain wooden chair at the foot of the steps in the palace of Ankh-Morpork. There was an ornate throne at the top of the steps, covered with dust. It was the throne of Ankh-Morpork and was indeed made of gold. He'd never dreamed of sitting on it. But it was a nice day, so he was working in the garden. Visitors to Ankh-Morpork were often surprised to find that there were some interesting gardens attached to the patrician's palace. The patrician was not a gardens kind of person, but some of his predecessors had been, and Lord Vetinari never changed or destroyed anything if there was no logical reason to do so. He maintained the little zoo and the racehorse stable, and even recognised that the gardens themselves were of extreme historic interest, because this was so obviously the case. They had been laid out by Bloody Stupid Johnson. Many great landscape gardeners have gone down in history and been remembered in a very solid way by the magnificent parks and gardens that they designed with almost godlike power and foresight, thinking nothing of making lakes and shifting hills and planting woodlands to enable future generations to appreciate the sublime beauty of wild nature transformed by man. There have been Capability Brown, Sagacity Smith, Intuition de Vere Slade Gore. In Ankh-Morpork, there was Bloody Stupid Johnson. Bloody stupid, it might look a bit messy now, but just you come back in 500 years' time, Johnson. Bloody stupid, look, the plans were the right way round when I drew them, Johnson. Bloody stupid Johnson, who had 2,000 tons of earth built into an artificial hillock in front of Quirm Manor, because it'd drive me mad to have to look at a bunch of trees and mountains all day long, how about you? The Ankh-Morpork Palace grounds were considered the high spot, if such it could be called, of his career. For example, they contained the ornamental trout lake, 150 yards long, and because of one of those trifling errors of notation that were such a distinctive feature of Bloody Stupid's designs, 1 inch wide. It was the home of one trout, which was quite comfortable provided it didn't try to turn around, and had featured an ornate fountain, which, when first switched on, did nothing but groan ominously for 5 minutes and then fire a small stone cherub 1,000 feet into the air. It contained the ho-ho, which was like a ha-ha, only deeper. A ha-ha is a concealed ditch and wall designed to allow landowners to look out across rolling vistas without getting cattle and inconvenient poor people wandering across the lawns. Under Bloody Stupid's errant pencil, it was dug 50 feet deep and had claimed 3 gardeners already. The maze was so small that people got lost looking for it. But the patrician rather liked the gardens, in a quiet kind of way. He had certain views about the mentality of most of mankind, and the gardens made him feel fully justified. Piles of paper were stacked on the lawn around the chair. Clerks renewed them or took them away periodically. There were different clerks. All sorts and types of information flowed into the palace, but there was only one place where it all came together, very much like strands of gossamer coming together in the centre of a web. A great many rulers, good and bad, and quite often dead, know what happened. A rare few actually manage, by dint of much effort, to know what's happening. Lord Vetinari considered both types to lack ambition. "Yes, Dr. Cruces," he said, without looking up.
"How the hell does he do it?"
Cruces wondered.
"I know I didn't make any noise." "Ah, Havelock,"
he began.
"You have something to tell me, Doctor?" "It's been mislaid." "Yes, and no doubt you are anxiously seeking it. Very well. Good day."
The patrician hadn't moved his head the whole time. He hadn't even bothered to ask what it was.
"He bloody well knows," thought Cruces. "How is it you can never tell him anything he doesn't know?"
Lord Vetinari put down a piece of paper on one of the piles and picked up another.
"You are still here, Dr. Cruces?" I can assure you, my lord, that...
I'm sure you can, I'm sure you can. There is one question that intrigues me, however.
My lord?
Why was it in your guild house to be stolen? I had been given to understand it had been destroyed. I'm quite sure I gave orders.
This was the question the assassin had been hoping would not be asked, but the patrician was good at that game.
That is, my predecessor, thought it should serve as a warning and an example.
The patrician looked up and smiled brightly.
Capital, he said. I have always had a great belief in the effectiveness of examples. So I'm sure you'll be able to sort this out with minimum inconvenience all round.
Certainly, my lord, said the assassin glumly, but...
Noon began. Noon in Ankh-Morpork took some time, since 12 o'clock was established by consensus. Generally, the first bell to start was that one in the Teachers' Guild in response to the universal prayers of its members. Then the water clock on the Temple of Small Gods would trigger the big bronze gong. The black bell in the Temple of Fate struck once, unexpectedly. But by then the silver pedal-driven carillon in the Fool's Guild would be tinkling, the gongs, bells and chimes of all the guilds and temples would be in full swing, and it was impossible to tell them apart, except for the tongueless and magical octoron bell of old Tom in the unseen university clock tower, whose 12 measured silences temporarily overruled the din. And finally, several strokes behind all the others, was the bell of the Assassin's Guild, which was always last. Beside the patrician, the ornamental sundial chimed twice and fell over.
"You were saying," said the patrician mildly.
"Captain Vimes," said Dr. Cruces, "he's taking an interest."
"Dear me, but it is his job."
"Really, I must demand that you call him off."
The words echoed around the garden. Several pigeons flew away.
"Demand?" said the patrician sweetly.
Dr. Cruces backed and filled desperately.
"He is a servant, after all," he said. "I see no reason why he should be allowed to involve himself in affairs that don't concern him."
"I rather believe he thinks he's a servant of the law," said the patrician.
"He's a jack-in-office and an insolent upstart."
"Dear me, I did not appreciate your strength of feeling. But since you demand it, I will bring him to heel without delay."
"Thank you."
"Don't mention it. Do not let me keep you."
Dr. Cruces wandered off in the direction of the patrician's idle gesture. Lord Vetinari bent over his paperwork again and did not even look up when there was a distant muffled cry. Instead, he reached down and rang a small silver bell. A clerk hurried up.
"Go and fetch the ladder, will you, Drumknot?" he said. "Dr. Cruces seems to have fallen into the ho-ho.